And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to Rates and Barrels. It's Thursday, August 4th. Derek Van Riper here with Eno Saris. We are now 2 days removed from the trade deadline, and what a trade deadline it was. We, of course, had our live stream on the Athletic Baseball Show. It's the 3-0 show episode for this week, which I think until Britt comes back should just be the 2-0 show. If we have a guest, we can call it the 3-0 show. If it's just the two of us,
the
2-0 show.
But will it be the 4-0 show when she comes back?
Yes, that's the question. How active will our new fourth host on the show be in the first few months? That's a good question. And a great unknown, really, for us as we continue potting. We'll talk about the busy trade deadline, some observations now that things have sunk in. Seems like an appropriate time to have a prospect of the week segment as well, so we will dig into that. We got a few mailbag questions to get to, some trading-related stuff as well. Now that we've had time to absorb it, the Soto trade, as it has come to be known, and San Diego's all-in push at this deadline, it's just fun because teams don't ordinarily go this hard all at once. And I think it is refreshing because the contrast of what the Brewers did, who they were a part of the teams that made deals with the Padres, trying to get it right long term and short term.
Thread the needle.
Trying to be perfect. Let's try to get a little better right now and have more long term value here. I think that's a really, really fine line to walk. And it's also, there's a few downsides to this. Like, it's so much easier to be the aggressive buyer because your team gets excited. Your fan base gets excited. Everyone loves you, right? If you're AJ Preller, you can do no wrong in this moment. When you try to thread the needle the way that David Stearns is trying
to. No one loves you.
Everyone turns against you. The people that are asked
your
about the moves.
Your own players.
The players are sad. You're a first place team and you made your team sad. Even if you didn't make your team worse, in the eyes of your team, you didn't get better. And that hurts them. That sends a message.
The poetic justice last night of the first inning for the Padres, walk from Juan Soto, walk from Josh Bell, grand slam from Brandon Drury, and then the ninth inning for the Brewers. I mean, it's coincidence, probably.
Yes, it is. It is coincidence.
But it really sort of underlined, I think, the boost that you can get from the fans were lined up outside the stadium in San Diego. So I know that the numbers say that a single acquisition doesn't drive attendance. At the same time, the intuitive underlying knowledge there that, like, caring matters and trying to improve the team seems to give everybody an uplift. I don't know. I think there's something there that we might just be missing when we analyze strict attendance numbers. I think the excitement level in San Diego is higher than it's ever been. And part of that is, you know, this big trade they made. The other thing that I think is really interesting about San Diego is that there, we just on the radio there. And, you know, I said that there's no homegrown players on this roster in San Diego. There are. We figured out who they were. Can you guess who the two homegrown San Diego Padres are that were drafted or acquired by San Diego?
Drafted or acquired as prospects?
Like, no, not acquired as prospects. Signed.
Signed, okay.
Drafted or signed by the Padres. There's only two of them.
That was a trade. I was just kind of quickly scanning the depth chart in my head. They're probably relievers. Is it two relievers?
Oh, that's good. That's smart. It's two relievers.
Adrian Morejon's still there, right?
Yes, that's one. They signed as an international free agent.
And then the other one would be, is it Reese Nair?
That's pretty good. I don't know if we looked at him, but it Stephen Wilson.
Stephen Wilson. Okay. But yeah,
there you go. Two guys.
Yeah, we develop players. What are you talking about? Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there are a lot of ways to build a team. And
no, this is fine. No, I'm not. Actually, in fact, I think it lines up really strongly with AJ Preller's best strength, right? His best strength is scouting and acquisition, you know, finding young players, you know, and if he can continue to replenish it, like, remember how he first came in and he traded away all the prospects for Kimbrell and Upton and
Kemp,
you know, Kemp, and he built that team. We all said, oh, what an awful idea. It turned out to be an awful idea, but not that long later, he had a whole bunch of new prospects.
Right.
You know, so that's a preview for my prospect of the week.
So here's the big question, right? You think about stuff like Taylor Rogers ultimately replacing Hader in the bullpen, even though it was Devin Williams who gave up the game-winning home run on Wednesday night. Is the gap between Hader and Rogers small enough over 2 months plus the playoffs to say it's so unlikely to make a meaningful difference that it's worth taking on a couple of prospects? It's worth taking on that risk to get young talent in the organization. Is David Stearns right, or is he doing more damage than he is actual good? Because the point of playing the game in the first place, as Herm Edwards famously said in his press conference years ago, you play to win. You play to win the game. Different sport, but same concept. Like when you're as good as the Brewers are, when you're a first place team, the foot should be on the gas. The teams that played the middle were bubble wild card teams and teams that didn't expect to even be close to playoff contention. That makes sense to me. But you can't play the middle when you're a front runner in your division.
I literally got a text message from an analyst in a front office saying they liked that trade. And of course, they liked it because they thought it was a marginal downgrade, if not much of a downgrade from Hader to Rogers. And they loved getting the new prospects. However, I would have to say the type of prospects you get in a reliever trade like this, even though it's Hader and it's one of the best relievers, it's not actually like going to really move the needle for me. Like, for example, Seattle last year did the same thing where they were threading the needle, right? And, you know, the Seattle was wrong and right and wrong again about this trade. Remember, it was beautiful. They trade away Kendall Graveman for Abraham Toro and then also traded for Diego Castillo. So they were improving themselves for the future. You know, I'm sure. Oh, who did the Brewers also trade for? It's like Trevor Rosenthal. It's very similar.
They added Rosenthal. They got Matt Bush, and then hey, your pitching model loves Matt Bush, by the way.
Like,
they quietly made the bullpen deeper, and it's only a little worse at its apex. At its absolute, like the A bullpen is just slightly worse, but the bullpen they use most often is probably better and deeper. And I think it's hard. I stare at baseball for a living, and it's hard for me to explain that to friends, family, fans, people that were saying, hey, why did they do this?
Well, it may not also be right. So here's my longer point. So, hey, the idea is free Abraham Toro, free Esteri Ruiz. Yay. Abraham Toro has shown us that why he was free.
Right.
And to me, Esteri Ruiz is going to do the same thing.
Yeah. You've explained some concerns.
He does not hit the ball hard. And also, he was being played in the corner outfield in the minors. Do you know the number of left fielders that have like 100 ISO?
They don't exist for very long.
Andrew Benintendi and Stephen Kwan are like, if Esteri Ruiz, he's not going to show that kind of strikeout rate, right? Like, there's like a 5% chance that Esteri Ruiz turns into Andrew Benintendi. Like, I really don't think that's going to happen. Guess who's third on the list that Esteri Ruiz could be? Tony MF and Kemp.
Yeah.
So free Tony Kemp. You know, like Tony Kemp is free.
Well, and the other argument here, so Robert Gosser might be a nice pitching prospect, but you're telling me if you just stayed put with Hayter now, you couldn't get a prospect like Robert Gosser as part of a trade in the offseason? Like, if the issue is, well, we don't want to pay Hayter in his last arbitration year because Mark Attanasio wants us to keep our payroll at $130 million. And if you have $130 million payroll, that's a bad use.
Anyway.
Fine. Okay. The owner-imposed limits keep you from retaining him. Make the trade later. It's the timing. I think it's just the timing that people are questioning.
It is the timing that you don't like. And maybe that's what makes sense here, actually, because maybe you don't get as good of a trade in the offseason because you don't have as desperate of teams. You know, in the offseason, they can go sign a free agent to be their closer.
Yep.
You know, and then all of a sudden, it's $16 million on the open market for a pretty good closer or $16 million for Josh Hayter plus a prospect. You know, so I think maybe that's the timing is the concern there. And, you know, they did get two free prospects and maybe Ruiz will prove me wrong. I think it's fascinating. I don't want to be wishy-washy and be like, I kind of prefer the Preller approach a little bit. I kind of prefer, I prefer the DePoto approach, but he did the same thing.
Right.
But, you know, I think it's a little different to go and get Diego Castillo than to get Matt Bush. I think it's a little different. Diego Castillo is under contract for another couple of years.
Right, Bush isn't. So, yeah, this doesn't help you in the long run in that particular area, but you helped yourself in another area. I don't know. Maybe the Brewers believe Esturio Ruiz can play center field. Maybe that's part of this, and yeah. I'm not on that. I mean, he's still playing
center field. Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll see. But they have outfielders at AAA. Sal Frelick is there. Garrett Mitchell's there.
Some people think Jack Centurio is the best prospect in baseball now.
Right. Also an outfielder. So I didn't quite understand it. I don't always understand the moves when they're made. I mean, if you look back at the last trade they made with the Padres, it looked like a big W for the Padres. Then it looked even. Then it started to look like a win for the Brewers. And now it's kind of trickling a little back closer to even again. But long term, that might end up looking just fine for Milwaukee. So I don't know.
The Brewers make fascinating trades, right?
And Denelson Lamet got DFA'd too.
Right. Well, I think that might have been matching salaries.
Right.
I think part of it was actually buying a prospect. Like, you know, they got Ruiz because they took on Lamet's money in order to make the Hayter thing work for the salary cap in San Diego.
Right, to get more than free Robert Gosser in the bullpen downgrade, they had to take back Lamet, but I reasonably thought that they could make Lamet a reliever.
Actually give him a chance. And put it, why not put him in, like, aren't there enough bad relievers in Milwaukee that they could just put him in the bad reliever pile until he pitches his way out of it?
I thought so, but the other plot twist is that apparently he just recently reached the service time point where he couldn't be optioned to AAA, even though he had options left without agreeing to it. So they either missed that or miscalculated it, or that was something else that I saw thrown out there. And so I don't know if they made that trade thinking they could send him down for a little while, but we'll see.
I wonder if there's certain things you can ask and certain things you can't ask a player. Like maybe they just weren't able to, maybe because of timing, they weren't able to reach out to Nelson Lamet and ask him if he would accept a demotion. Because there's the whole thing in Toronto where they traded for Whit Merrifield, who isn't vaccinated. And then somebody asked them and they were like, well, we didn't ask him, but it's pretty obvious that we want him to get vaccinated.
Right. I just think of like all the players you could trade for if you had any doubt about a willingness to do that, given where you play and given the requirements to be eligible to play, you'd think you would know before doing that. But hey, you know, I'm here and they're over there making those decisions. So I'm very surprised that they didn't have some kind of understanding.
I think they probably read between the lines of his last statement, like where there was sort of like, for a contender... You know? And they're like, well, we're a contender.
I got to ask you this. I put it on Twitter on Wednesday and got a few responses that I thought were pretty interesting. But do you think the tension between playing for now in baseball and playing for later would just be eased if we had shorter paths to free agency, both just in terms of number of years before you have to go on the 40-man and, of course, number of years before you reach free agency? Because I just think the bankable years of an undervalued player, we've talked about how that's led to even fans and readers and everyone kind of fetishizing young players coming back in a trade. I think you'd also just push everyone in the general direction of caring more about today if you didn't have these long future windows to dream on when you acquire a player that's never even played in the big leagues before, someone that's really, really low in terms of service time?
No, I think it would push more teams to play for the now, if that was the case. But I think it's something that the union wants every year and something the owners are not willing to give. So,
yeah, seems like a non-starter, but I am increasingly just frustrated by this idea that we can play both.
Even, you know, one less year of the minimum would do that. You know,
right. Just go to arbitration faster. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Attacking that structure in any way would lead to better outcomes. I also wonder about the incentives of TV money, sort of guaranteed TV money coming in versus what you get from attendance. If you could change that somehow, if you could make it more important to have attendance, like if you could, I don't know, it's not like you're going to take TV money away. Everybody wants that guaranteed money, but there is a certain like level that teams get to. They're like, okay, we want to spend exactly what we're promised, and then the attendance will be the icing on top, you know? And that leads to a lot of like, this is all we can spend.
And that's the last part. I'm not trying to make this all about the Brewers. They're just doing this thing that I think people can get really frustrated by right now. If they had done everything they did and then made a move to get one more bat or just something, some other impact kind of player, and it pushed the payroll up.
A lot of people thought it was a precursor to something.
I certainly did. I got fooled. But if they'd done that, I think the reaction would be a lot different. And we talk about it all the time. The caps that GMs work with, front offices work with, are set by ownership. That's just, those are self-imposed. Like, that's just what they are.
But they didn't spend Hader $16 million next year.
Right. They didn't get a player that's going to make that. They didn't go out and make the move for a Luis Castillo. Not that they needed pitching, but the player that would be there in 2023 that would also make them better and cover that. They did it with a cheap league minimum player and a
Reynolds or
prospect.
Laureano would be somebody who'd be a little bit more expensive next year that would play now, you know.
It sends
might
a different
cost
message.
You one of those outfield prospects.
Yeah, because then if you're rooting for that team or you're in that clubhouse, you're saying, well, we're gonna miss Josh, but we got more relievers, which is great. You know, we're all confident in our ability and we've got an upgrade to our offense. We feel great about where things are at right now. Instead, it was kind of like, yeah, I don't get it. I could even kind of detect it a little bit. I think it was Craig Counsell. Yeah, it was Craig Counsell before the game was talking to the media, and he just had Counsell's not like a super high or super low guy most of the time. He's very even keeled as a manager. You could just kind of feel it in his voice too, where it was just like, yeah, we got some good guys back there. And I don't know. Like I listened to him. Like, this is a guy that is probably not happy about this decision, even if he fully understands why it was made. Right? Like that's just the way you have to live, I guess, in a situation
like
that.
Too, because Milwaukee has not been good. Listen, I think their pitcher player development is great. I think on the hitting side, you know, aren't most of their hitters traded for?
Off the top of your head, how many Brewers starters?
Tyrone Taylor.
Yep.
That's all I can come up with.
They didn't develop Narvaez. They didn't develop Rowdy. They signed Colton Wong as a free agent. They traded for Willy Adames.
Yeah.
Luis Urias was a trade.
Omar
Yelich
Narvaez
was a trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hunter Renfroe was a trade.
So they got, you know, they got some hitting prospects. They haven't been amazing at turning those into players. Are they just going to turn around and trade them again? I don't know.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them. You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Who's more angry today? You got to scale numbers down. There's more Mets fans out there. Mets fans or Brewers fans? Who's more disappointed by the deadline?
More disappointed per capita.
Yeah, more disappointment per capita. Brewers fans or Mets fans?
I don't know. I'm on Twitter too much, so I would say probably Mets fans or Yankees fans. Ooh, good Lord. Yankees fans were not happy.
Well, Yankees fans can be a little over the top with their expectations.
But they threaded the needle too, right? I mean, they did go get Montas. So like that's unfair to say that. But at the same time, trading Jordan Montgomery for Harrison Bader does have money implications. And I think it has something to do with next year's payroll.
That was the thing that they did last minute. We talked about it in the stream. It was like, why? You don't have enough pitching depth to do that. You just went out and acquired an impact starter for good reason.
All they have is Clark Schmidt now. I mean, maybe Davey Garcia, but I think depending on him, that guy is not pitching well and has been hurt a lot and wasn't that great when he was better. So I'd say they have Clark Schmidt and they're just sort of holding on to the side of their seat, yelling "Wee!"
So Mets fans are.
I also in a piece today I detailed. Do you realize how much injury past all their current starters have?
The
other
Yankees?
Than Cole. Yeah. Tyone has two Tommy Johns. Herman was on the IL for shoulder injury this year. Luis Severino is on the IL for shoulder injury right now. Frankie Montas was on the IL for shoulder injury earlier this season.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. This is a team that doesn't need a guy who's proven to be healthy over the past few years. I don't know. That one's weird. But yeah, I think with the Mets, they drew a line, and I think the one that I wouldn't have drawn, I think I would have traded Mark Vientos for Wilson Contreras. If that was on the board, and I bet it was, I would have done that trade because Vientos is striking out a lot in AAA. You know, he plays third base. It's not necessarily a premium position. It's not like he's a young shortstop that you got to hold on to. And you got to trade somebody. Keep Beatty, keep Francisco Alvarez, fine. But like, you can trade, you know, one of your prospects for a big upgrade at the catcher position. But otherwise, I would say the Mets are just an amazing team. They're just like pretty well built. They have depth everywhere. Like, and they really, their worst spot was DH, and they improved it with a Vogelruff.
Vogelruff, yeah, yeah.
Ruffenbacher. They have a Vogelbach, Darren Ruff combo back there that should be good, righty-lefty. And, you know, that was their worst position before. So they did do something. It's just pretty small.
The biggest critiques, I think, for the Mets were behind the plate, especially with James McCann hurt. But even with James McCann healthy, they could use an upgrade. That was the spot that they should have upgraded. If you want to say that they failed at the deadline because of that, I think you're just looking for a reason to be extra harsh. I think it's disappointing. But at the same time, they did upgrade in terms of getting more power. They do have more depth. And that's one thing that the Mets have been doing going back to the offseason. They've built a deeper team than they've had in a long time. I think that bodes really well for their chances of mixing and matching down the stretch, having the right guys in the right spot in the postseason as well. So it's not sexy. It's not sexy to go, yeah, we got Tyler Naquin, Darren Ruff, and Daniel Vogelbach. Guess what? Like they're better the way they are now. They are improved, and they had a top five offense as it was previously constructed. The flaw was they didn't hit enough home runs. Most of the guys they brought back, that's the thing they do first. They hit home runs, and I think that's actually a good sort of way to go if you're there. And I think the other question with the Mets was, did they need one more pitcher because of Jacob DeGrom just coming off the IL? You know, Carrasco's injury history, Taiwan Walker's got a few injuries as well. You could look at that group and say, do they need one more guy to get them
David
there.
Peterson and Trevor Williams are not, you know, my favorite starting pitchers, but, you know, compared to just having Clark Schmidt, you know, and you have Megill, you know, on his way back. I think he's a big question mark, but that is a superior depth position than the Yankees. In the bullpen, I think they could have maybe added someone in the bullpen to just lengthen it.
But
the Michael
lefty.
Givens, yeah. Yeah, the Michael Givens one was weird for me because by stuff he's really lost a lot and he was already below average, and so I think he's what they're like fifth best reliever.
Yeah, because Diaz, Lugo, Ottavino, and May.
And May when he's healthy. And May's coming back.
Yeah, those guys are all better than Givens. So I don't know. I mean, other than not adding a lefty.
Maybe it would cost too much to get someone who is actually better than any of those three?
I get it. Look, I am a fan of a team that underwhelmed me at the deadline, and I can understand, but I don't think it's as bad as
making out to
me. But the
Mets and the Yankees, they should be elephants stomping through the forest, right? Like they should just do everything. You know, well, they should have a ridiculous bullpen. They should go out and put David Robertson in that bullpen just because they could.
That's a good push here, because I think what we don't know about the Mets is what's Billy Epler going to do. At any given point, is he going to be that kind of GM, or is he going to try and be a thread the needle type? And this is more what a thread the needle GM would do. And I don't know if threading the needle works in New York. You can get away with it maybe in Milwaukee if
Stomp
you get the results.
Through the forest and be a beast.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the probably the part that's frustrating. It's like, well, if this were any other team, this would be okay. But expectations
Preller didn't
are
just get
here.
Soto. He got Bell and Hader. You know?
Like, and Drury.
And Drury. Like, he just didn't care.
He needed all those upgrades, though.
Yeah.
They were a tier below the best of the best teams in the league, even
By
when
war,
Tatis was getting healthy.
They're fourth now.
Yeah.
In a virtual tie with the Braves for fifth. So.
And what were they before all their moves? Like, 15th?
7th or 8th, no.
Oh, okay. They're even
but
lower.
But it's just it doesn't, you can't move the needle that much because it's 2 months and it's war.
See, I thought they were lower in part because, well, I guess Tatis would have been factored into the projections all along, but they were a very average lineup without Tatis, yeah. Especially.
Yeah, for sure. They definitely added more war at the deadline than anybody else.
So I've decided... with more time to let it sink in, Brandon Marsh for Logan Ohapi is my favorite swap of the deadline. Easily my favorite trade, because it was the one we just didn't see coming.
My whole piece today, for sure.
Well, that's always appreciated. So, like, what else made the cut? I didn't get a chance to read your piece yet, so this is all going to be new to me as we're talking
Montgomery,
about it.
Montgomery and the Marsh trade were my most intriguing. There was five intriguing ones. The Blue Jays trade... and the Siri trade in Tampa. But Marsh was really... And actually, what's interesting, there is a common thread here. Marsh, Bader, Siri. They're among the three... They're three of the five best center fielders by outs above average this year. So there were three teams that went and got elite defensive center fielders... I don't know if it's a trend. You know, every time, like, is it a trend or is it AJ Preller? You know, like,
I think it's a reminder that there are a few spots where teams really still prioritize elite defense, and center field is one of them. And most contending teams already have a shortstop in place, so they're not usually trading for shortstops because that's not how it works. But you can actually trade for great defensive center fielders.
Yeah, that's true. And the through line for all of them is there enough bat? And in fact, of the three, I think Bader, a guy who, you know, in our tiers project, they said, the scouts said they weren't sure he had a carrying tool bat, like he had a bat, an everyday bat. He has the best bat of these three at least in terms of projections. I like Marsh, and I like him more than Siri. But I was surprised by how similar they are. They both strike out like 35% of the time. They both barrel around 9% of the time. They both have, you know, 111, 112 max exit velos. You know, the one difference is Siri has a swinging strike rate of around 18, which is high. and Marsh has one more around 13. So, and has like a actual reasonable swinging strike rate against fastballs. So, you know, there may be more to work with there. And also, Marsh had lower strikeout rates in the minors. So there may be more to work with there, to a possibility of getting him to 28, 26% strikeout rate. If you do, I could see a breakout for Marsh. Plus, Marsh is in a nice stadium for his offense. I think this was a good deal for him. O'Hop is also interesting because he's an offensive catcher right before automatic balls and strikes.
Yeah, I know. You've mentioned the timetable for that. It seems like you have a more aggressive timeline for that than
it's on the way, man. It's like, it's like in double A. If it's in double A, it's like, treat it like a prospect. If it's in double A, it's coming, man. It's like 1 or 2 years. So I think the over under is a year and a half. You know, it's either 2 years or 1 year is my guess.
All right.
So But, you know, I think it's also interesting that the Angels, you know, there's this finding that Matt Swartz had that teams know better about their own players than other teams in free agency. I don't know if that's been proven in trades like this, but it is interesting that the Angels got an everyday look at Brandon Marsh. They developed him. They brought him up. They released Justin Upton this year because they said Brandon Marsh and Joe Adell are the future. And then they traded away Brandon Marsh.
I think it's possible, and this is something I talked about with Al on the Fantasy Baseball podcast this morning. It's possible that something with Marsh is true like that, where they see something they can't fix. So they say, well, we need a catcher for the future. It's kind of hard to find those, and Logan O'Hoppe's blocked in Philly. Like, JT Realmuto's not going anywhere anytime soon. So they saw an opportunity to get better at an important position for them. They've got pretty good outfield depth. I was trying
to
decide.
They really needed a center fielder.
Does it really mean anything as far as the long-term health of Mike Trout? Like the Angels' willingness to move a major league-ready center fielder? Probably not, actually, just because it's one important position for another. And I think it's easier to go out and find outfield help than it is to go out and find impact catchers.
Well, I think Adell can probably play center. There's a wild card here, which is weird. Marsh was slated for center, and Trout was like, nah,
no, I want to play center. Yeah, it was weird.
And I think for my team, if we were about winning games, Trout's not in center field for me.
No, he would not be.
If he's the leader of the team and you're like, if he wants to play center, he's going to play center again next year, then I guess you trade away the guy who is not a great left fielder in terms of offense and
is
a better center fielder. So it's a little bit of a, like, team fits for both, I guess, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm with you. I just think that was a pretty interesting deadline. I think the Angels, they could have panicked in the wake of the Trout news. They could have moved Ohtani too, and it was clear before the deadline that they decided they weren't really going to make that happen, at least now. Maybe it'll happen this winter if it happens at all. I think a lot's going to hinge on just the overall health of some players coming back. But surprised they moved Raisel Iglesias in that multi-year deal, because if they thought their window was still as open as it was going into this season, getting rid of an impact reliever probably wasn't the thing that made the most sense.
Yeah,
counter-argument to that, though, Tucker Davidson comes back. Controllable pitching for them, it's important.
And starting pitching has been as hard for them as anything. Maybe they feel like they can just go out and spend $15 million a year again on a new reliever. Maybe go get Kenley Jansen,
right? Yeah, because Iglesias goes to Atlanta. You can make a one-year deal with Jansen. You don't have the multi-year closer anymore, and you've got other good relievers. So that could be part of their plan.
But I did sell low on Mike Trout in one of my leagues.
What'd you get?
This might offend some people. I might get some yelling. I did have a friend tell me that I did poorly. It's a keep six, and he's like a fourth rounder. So he's, you know, you keep him at their round. So he was already my most expensive keeper. My other keepers were like Yordan Alvarez in like the 10th, you know, Shohei Ohtani in like the 11th. So, like, you know, I have some really great keepers. I won last year, and I'm in the yeah, thank you. Those of you on YouTube can see which way Derek is already leaning. Anyway, I'm making excuses. But I traded him because I thought of him as my fifth best keeper out of six. I traded him for people that I'm not sure I'm going to keep, but may help me win this year, which is Rhys Hoskins at first base. going into a timeshare or pushing Rowdy Tellez to the bench. And Stephen Kwan in center, who pushes Aaron Hicks off of my team. So I think and this is a league with K's by batters. I also got Noelvi Marte. We have four free minor league keepers every year.
Okay.
So I got Noelvi Marte as the minor league keeper that's free. Maybe Hoskins goes into a group with Bregman and Gleyber Torres as my final keeper. So I went from Trout as my final bat keeper to one of Hoskins, Bregman, or Gleyber Torres. And for that, I got Stephen Kwan, who I was running Aaron Hicks out at center, and I need to do better. So it's now a Hicks Profar center field platoon. I guess maybe I didn't do enough, but here's my thinking. Here's my thinking on Trout. We talked to a back expert, in email, who is talking about this. I have very little faith he's coming back this year. First of all, the Angels aren't good, and there's no reason for him to come back. And secondly, this is the type of injury I gather from speaking with this back expert that is fairly serious, and you should give it all the chance to heal. Now, he seemed to suggest that if you give it all the chance to heal and to heal well, he might be fine going forward. However, what I see with Trout is this ongoing issue where if there are any injuries, he's just going to be done for the year if the Angels are bad. So I bet against the Angels as much as I did Trout, because Trout could go back into next year and be like, I feel good, everything's fine. He could play for 3 months, find some nagging injury, Angels are out of it. He's like, nah, peeps, I'll be back again next year. So has that not described like the last 2 years?
It's fair, totally fair. And you know, look at the games played count and go all the way back to 2017, 114, 140, 134. So not bad those 2 years, but some wear and tear starting to pile up. 53 out of 60 in the shortened season, 36 last year. And if he's done this year, 79. We don't have confirmation of that. It's just speculation.
It's a high risk that if the Angels are bad again and he's got some sort of injury, he's just going to be out. Plus, he was the most expensive keeper I had, so...
Yeah, well, okay. So it's not a bad trade. I'm not gonna be as mean to you as your friend was in this case. I think your theory about how they would handle him makes sense. The organizational track record over the better part of 20 years would lead you to believe that you're acting on the side of, yeah, any sort of nagging problem is gonna shut Trout down. And even if we're talking about 2 to 3 seasons into the future where he's still a player as talented as he is now. Very good impact player, keepable in a league like yours for sure during that window for the per game production. How difficult is it to replace him in your league, I think, is a huge question, and how valuable he is too. I think we're starting to push Trout into this sort of like stars and scrubs. Like if you're in a 10-team league and you only start 3 outfielders, it's really easy to replace a player when he's out. And then the per game production is still so good that he's a difference maker. In those cases, he fits really well. If you're talking about a 20-team dynasty league, that's a totally different calculus. The waiver wire replacement. And then, of course, where you are in a long-term league. Are you playing for now, which you are? Okay.
That's an argument for buying Trout, I think. And I'm comfortable with it because we're only a 12-team league, but it's fairly deep. And, for example, I was cobbling together my center field, and it was Aaron Hicks, Jock Peterson, and Jurickson Profar. So that's a pretty low level of production I was getting, and so you know it's fair, and maybe I made the wrong move, but I also would rather be a year early than a year late on some of these declining older bats. And I like Noelvi Marte a lot, especially coming up in Cincinnati, and then on top of it I had a chance to win this year, and I don't think Mike Trout's coming back this year. So this part of it was, you get a better keeper, I'll have to figure out my last keeper. But I want to win this year. I'm in third place. If I can run somebody better than Aaron Hicks out in center field, maybe I can win this.
Trout turns 31 on Sunday. What does someone get Mike Trout for a birthday gift at this point?
Buy-in for his next fantasy football league.
It sounds like he is kind of a donor.
Or I take over commish for you. That's a real good birthday present.
That's one of those gifts. You know when you sometimes you see like a charity auction and it's a like gift value. priceless. Like being the commissioner of that league, I mean, obviously he was in over his head in that case. I was thinking maybe Mike Trout would like an astrolabe, which there's an episode of The Simpsons where Homer buys an astrolabe.
What's
so,
an astrolabe?
It's an ancient astronomical instrument that was a handheld model of the universe. So it's
I think he might like something like that.
That seems like a thing Trout would actually you know, find some appreciation for. But I think the commissioning is the best thing. You got him the better gift than I did. I got him I got him a piece of junk that he'll look at once and throw in the corner. Yeah. So I'm sure we'll have a ton of Mike Trout talk between now and opening day next year, because why wouldn't we?
It's going to keep coming back up.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Let's get to our Prospect of the Week segment.
Prospect of the Week.
I like how you added the music to the vocals for yourself, too, just making my job easier at every possible turn. Since you're very excited for this segment, I think you should go first. Who is your selection? You probably have more than one. I don't think there'd be a rule against that. There really are no rules on this show. There are very few rules, at least.
I have one. I just wanted to bring this guy up because he belongs in that San Diego Padres conversation we're having. There's a lot of excitement about Jackson Merrill. 19-year-old shortstop in A-ball for the Padres, and totally could be the next C.J. Abrams that jumps up into, you know, the top 15 and the top 10 over the next couple of years, depending on how he ages. I think the one thing we're watching is the power, and he does hit too many ground balls, but he makes a lot of contact, has good patience, very athletic, great tools, and I think the defense to stay at shortstop. So, you know, picking up an A-ball guy is better than picking up a low A or a complex guy. So at least he's moved his way out of that. Obviously, it can go any direction from here because he's a 19-year-old in A-ball. But I just want to mention that because maybe he's already found the next prospect he's going to trade away.
It's good chance, good way to look at it. I've decided that because I very rarely say nice things about the Oakland A's, that I should talk about an A's prospect. And I was doing some leaderboard surfing over at RotoWire. They've got hard hit data on prospects. And Jordan Diaz, a third baseman in the A's organization, actually stood out to me. Really young for the level. He's 21 years old. He's played all season at AA Midland, so that's a great place to be for a player that age. He's popped 14 homers, the 307, 354, 506 line. Not a guy that I've heard a whole lot about. I don't dig into a lot of prospect pods outside of the fantasy episode I host with Al every week, just preparing for that. So probably a guy that could creep into some top 100s, just looking at what he's doing in terms of the underlying numbers. Again, age to level, clear path to an opportunity. And I saw that they took Zach Geloff, who's missed some time this year with a shoulder injury, and they were starting to play him at second base. So it almost looks like they're trying to figure out how those two players might fit together on the same infield in the not so distant future. So Jordan Diaz, a sneaky prospect to probably add. I don't mean the league you described where you get four minor leaguers. That's probably not a deep enough league, because that would mean you to be basically a top 50 sort of prospect to be on the radar in a league like that. But a watch list player for leagues like that, and then probably a must add type in leagues where at least 10 prospects are rostered by each team.
And honestly, if you keep four minor leaguers, you may just eliminate pitchers from your keeper pool completely. In which case, you're just asking him to be a top 50 bat prospect, you know, top 60 type bat prospect. So, you know, he could be on, he's probably still on the outside looking in for that. But, you know, one thing that I would monitor with him, and I love his combination of, you know, strikeout rate and isolated slugging. I just want that ground ball rate to just keep getting a little bit lower, you know.
Yeah.
And so far, so good, but his fly ball rate is also the lowest it's been in his career right now at this stop. So there's something there. I want to see some growth in the ground ball fly ball mix, but otherwise, good pull.
Yeah, hard contact up a bit from where it was last year, 27.5%. Sports Info Solutions provides that data on the RotoWire pages. Those are scored manually, so they give you a good approximation. But again, age to level has to be a consideration with Diaz, but also age for contact quality is something that I think is really important. Hit locations look really good in terms of using the entire field. Maybe doesn't pull the ball enough. That could be something he does more in the future as he advances.
Could be a way to unlock some power, yeah.
Yeah, but I really like the overall approach here. Nice low K rate, really productive season at AA, and just trying to give A's fans something to be excited about too, because it's bleak right now, but you know, two to three years from now, maybe it'll start to get a little bit better. Let's get to a few emails here. Got one from Pete. Pete writes, I was ecstatic to get Ronald Acuna at the turn in my 10-man redraft league, and he quickly dashed any lingering injury concern by swiping bags at a higher rate than he has the past few years. But outside of an earlier power surge, his pop seems to have disappeared. He's had some bad luck on balls in play, so I'm being patient. But it's getting harder to watch him roll over on pitches night in and night out. Any real concern here? Love the show. P.S. Spent part of this summer with my kids in the mountains of Zacatecas, Mexico, and when I had signal, I would download the weekly episodes for our longer drives. After a couple of weeks, my kids and their cousins would fight to ride in my rental car because they wanted to listen to the Baseball Nerds.
That might be a new name for the show.
Yeah, yeah. It could just be Rates and Barrels, : the Baseball Nerds.
Love it. No, Acuna is obviously struggling a little bit. I want to know if it has anything to do with the knee or it's just something mechanical. I mean, he's obviously hitting too many ground balls and pulling too many ground balls, so that, you know, the rollover critique is there. At the same time, you know, the max EV says the raw power is still there, and the barrel rate is the same as it was in 2019 where he hit 41 homers. That's the rabbit ball, so you would have to change that number, but I would just say that the raw power is there. He's not reaching he's reaching more than they did last year, but it's not a ton. I see he's like a tweak away, you know, like I think something's going to click for him.
I think one thing that we can still, the collective, we, not you and I specifically, the one thing that we can really overlook sometimes with a hitter coming off of a leg injury is the importance of your legs in hitting. I wouldn't discount that right now. I'd look at this and say everything in the barrel percentages looks comparable to what it was earlier in his career. You know, the hard hit rates being in line, the strikeout rate still being good, the eye at the plate still looks good.
Pulled grounders means something's off. He's definitely something off there. He's pulling off on those.
But it seems fixable to me, because of the quality of the contact, even though he's not hitting the ball in the air as often as we'd like. So if there is any any glimmer of being able to make a move for Acuna in a long-term league right now, absolutely do it. It's disappointing to not have that power, but the steals are so valuable right now too that I think he's been better than I expected, even though it's been in a different shape. Like the production has come a different way so far.
What is his what's his earned value?
While I look it up, what do you think
he picked
it is?
He picked him 10th or 11th, so I'm guessing it's not 10th or 11th. I'm guessing it's not top 10, but I'm guessing it's still maybe top 20, in which case maybe he's not producing exactly as you wanted, but he's not tanking your team.
So let's have a look. I'm looking at 15-team leagues using the RotoWire in-season number. $14 is what it spits out for Acuna, so that's not top 20. It's actually
top 40.
Top 60, I think, would be where that is. But right. Hold on a minute, though. I do think the raw earn value numbers are a little bit unfair when we're comparing someone who missed 30-ish games compared to everybody above him. So if you adjust it for time lost, because you're thinking about Acuna plus whoever you had to replace him.
Yeah,
you didn't take
a
zero.
Date filter on that?
It'd be awesome if you could. I think he's probably more like a low 20s player since coming back. And that does kind of put him in the, I don't know, the Trout, Harper, Seager, Abreu, Matt Olson. Those guys all do it different ways. But that would be pretty good. That's closer to like a top 20, top 25 hitter.
None of those
on a per game basis.
Picks, though.
No.
Well, Trout and Harper were.
Well, it's a major injury. I mean, it's great to see him running as much as he has, because I thought that'd be the last thing to come back. And I'm starting to think that maybe stealing bases is not the hardest thing about coming off of a torn ACL. Still hitting the ball might actually be the hardest thing about it. But thanks for the email, Pete, and I'm glad that your kids and their cousins were enjoying the show. Even if they were just making fun of us the whole time, at least it made some of those drives a little easier to get through. I've got a question here from John. John's writing about an auto new points league in rebuild mode. Had a few stars this year, including Trey Turner, Jose Ramirez, Ronald Acuna, Jose Berrios. He was hoping to flip prospects, and that didn't exactly work out. So he had to settle, try to get better by realizing that trading for hurt players is actually easier to get surplus value on the roster. So the question is, how do you evaluate injured players like Tyler Stevenson or Kyle Lewis? Putting prices aside, it seems like those are players that teams are just willing to move on from. When you're thinking about multi-year players like that, you know, like are there certain injuries that you're comfortable buying into and certain injuries that you're not? I mean, is it certain positions, certain skills? When do you feel like injury risk in a long-term league is worth seeking out?
You know, the Kyle Lewis thing is interesting because this year it's been a concussion that laid him low after the knee thing. But I think it's the knee thing that's more worrisome, because that's more of a chronic situation that's going to be managed over his career and probably puts an earlier end date on his career and means that he's, you know, there's going to be load management involved. And, you know, I just see that as you know, being a bigger deal. The Stevenson thing is a major injury that may affect him next year, but I think at some point he'll be back to 100%, and I doubt it leads to chronic problems. I mean, it all has to do with what it looks like when you get in there. I think how displaced the fracture was and, you know, how long the recovery is and stuff. So... you know, stuff that a doctor could answer better. But I think just generally nagging, especially like sort of bone on bone. Remember how Utley's career ended? He had bad knees and he was still good when he was in. But it was kind of a, you know, if I remember correctly. I'm actually going to look up Utley's numbers now that I said all that, but
I remember a pretty sharp decline there. I don't think you're off base, but you can confirm in just a moment.
Yeah, for last few 4 years, 400 plate appearances, 500, 350, 200. So,
yeah, I really caught up to him in those later years. I think with Kyle Lewis, that's the type of chronic injury risk that, yeah, there's a discount there. In a long-term league, I'm really not that interested. I think he's better served in short-term situations where people might be undervaluing
maybe
him.
You catch lightning in a bottle and, you know, he's actually healthy for the last couple of months.
Yeah, but I think in multi-year leagues, I don't think you're looking at Kyle Lewis as a, you know, $1, $3, $5 in-season pickup that you're going to hold for multiple years and say, yeah, he's been great. He's been a $15 or $20 guy year over year over year after dealing with knee stuff up to this point in his career. It's unfortunately just one of those things that's going to hang around, I think.
But Stevenson, if let's say next year it's not he's not 100% or whatever, or he doesn't have the whole offseason to train, he's not as strong. Let's say you get 80% out of Stevenson. Well, let's say he's like a $3 catcher or something, right? So that means, you know, in 2025, he's a $7 catcher. He might still be worth that, you know, and he'd still be worth keeping at that level. And he might be cheap enough where maybe next year you have to buy like a $5 or $6 catcher to pair with him just to make sure that you have two good catchers. Like at least between one of them, you have a usable catcher. But he'd still have value going forward. And if you might see by the end of next year, oh, the exit velocities are creeping up, the barrel rate's creeping up, you know, he's starting to get good again. You know, he's starting to. So I kind of like a catastrophic injury like that in the better in a way. Like it's just one injury. It's like as opposed to sort of a collection of soft tissue, nagging, knee problem type stuff. I don't like that.
Yeah, that's kind of the key difference for me. You know, the devastating one-off injuries, they're not easy to come back from, but I'm not as worried about it once the rehab is complete as I am about something that's bothered a player for Kyle Lewis with his knees. It feels like it's been 5+ years now.
Yeah, we both think Acuña is going to be great next year.
Right.
Like a first-round talent even.
Yes, I would agree. I think that's still where I expect him to go. And of course, he's got 2 months and change to persuade everybody with more production the further he gets away from that injury. But thanks a lot for that question, John. We got another email here. This is a trade question for Ben. It's a keep seven league with a 260 salary cap. It's a 10-team rotisserie situation. And there's some salaries here, of course, so I'm going to run through this real quick. It's a simple trade. Give away Bobby Witt Jr. in a trade. He's at 15 as a keeper. And get back Corbin Burns at 27. The other keepers include Devers at 44, Eloy at 27, who must be kept, Wander at 15, Jazz Chisholm at 15, Joe Musgrove at 15, and Adley Rutschman at 5. So not a lot of pitching on that team. Giving up the, you know, more interesting young player that can do everything, especially steal bases. If Devers is 44, though, as a keeper, and you could keep Burns at 27, like if Burns were back in the auction, he'd go for 40+, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe your best pitcher on the board might even go for 50.
And what was Witt? But Witt's price?
Witt
was 15.
So it'll progress and he'll stay behind Burns for a while. So
I
long
love
as they can
what
be kept.
Witt is doing, dude. His chase rate has just gone down over the course of the season. I think he's settling in, and I think he's a really top talent. I think he should be like I might push him to like second round next year. I don't have my whole board in front of me, but you know, like I'm pretty excited about Bobby Witt. I wouldn't do it.
All right. So you like Witt enough to not lock in the top end pitcher at a slight discount because the multi-year discount on Witt you think is more valuable.
Over year over year. I think you're going to keep Witt for 3, 4, 5 years and Burns, you know, I don't know. Do they get more expensive over time?
They do. I think we've got for 2024, Witt's only 20 and Burns becomes 38. That's a pretty big jump. So because Witt moves up slower.
Might be a one-year deal for Burns or maybe two.
Could be. So I think with that, that's enough to keep it on the preferring the Witt side. And wow, being stuck with Eloy at 27 is not great. But that's a conversation for a different day. But thanks a lot for that email, Ben. I got a question about Walker Buehler that came in from Matt. Matt wants to know if Walker Buehler's problems before he got hurt were just a one-off thing or if they were signs of longer-term issues trying to look to make some trades in a keeper league where they can keep 8 players. Don't know if I should move him or someone like Spencer Strider or George Kirby for hitting help. So if you had injured Buehler and people were interested versus Strider, who looks amazing, and Kirby, who we've talked about a lot on this show.
Trade Buehler.
Are you trading Buehler?
Yes, I would trade Buehler. There was a drop-off in stuff on his four-seam that was pretty dramatic. He was still pretty good, and we saw Urias kind of have a drop-off in stuff and kind of shrug it off and had a great year and figure it out. But I just think that Buehler is more dependent on his velo than Urias. You can also look at it from a traditional standpoint, which is he's always outperformed his strikeout rate and his swing strike rate. You know, and usually players don't do that over the long run. So I think there's two ways to look at Buehler that you sort of, you know, wonder if the production is going to continue even when he comes back from injury. Plus, he's injured. So, like, they could turn into Tommy John. Like, it still could.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I would trade Buehler in this situation. Like, I'm definitely not trading Strider. That's like a rocket ship taking off for the moon. What was the other one?
Kirby.
I like Kirby, too. He's very different than the other two. More of a command guy. But he's got a bunch of pitches. The stuff is improving a little bit over time. And the slider command is elite. So, I'm going to take Kirby, too.
All right. Yeah, I'm on board with that. I mean, I just think the dip for Buehler probably brings him down to, I don't know, top 10, top 15 starting pitcher ceiling. Whereas pre-decline with that stuff, he had that top 5 sort of cap that we'd seen in a few seasons. So it's a lower ceiling with added risk. And if you can move that for a bat that you'd love to keep, I mean, you're probably not getting first, second round bats back in the return, but some of those third, fourth round caliber bats can be just as good. You may not even get that
for Kirby. I mean, Strider might. The one argument for trading Strider is Strider might get you whenever you want.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, Strider might get you ridiculous stuff back. But even then,
the other team might say, how many innings am I going to get the rest of the season? It may have to be with like a rebuilder.
Yeah. Well, this might be all about long term value.
But you're trading Buehler to a rebuilder. I guess if the return, if the other team says, I give you whatever you want for Strider and I'll just give you this list for Buehler, then maybe compare the lists. But my instinct is to say trade Buehler.
But more importantly, the broader answer to the question here is that you saw enough of a decline in Buehler before this injury to alter expectations for him. Even if he comes back healthy and this ends up being an injury that doesn't impact him all that much in the future, but I think there is a chance this is the kind of thing that comes back as something more serious. Certainly encouraging to see him working his way back so far. Of course, the end of the day, Tuesday, we got very sad news in the baseball world. Vin Scully passed away at the age of 94, and I think as many people have said, he's the voice of baseball. Like he did that. His career was just incredible, and I think my favorite thing if I'd watch Dodgers games was to just hear Vin spin the yarn and tell stories that you never expected. And I was wondering if you had a favorite Vin Scully call or story or moment from several years of just enjoying the games he was calling, because I had the story that sticks in my head is the one he told about Madison Bumgarner and his wife coming across a snake. And Bumgarner, not knowing if it was a rattlesnake or not, decided that he had to take out the snake with an axe. So he cuts up the snake to kill it, and they find find rabbits inside, baby rabbits, and they nurse them back to health, which is just an absolutely absurd story. And just Vin casually telling it as he's calling the game, the way he really only he did, just weaving things in and out, like you didn't miss a second of the game, and you were glued to the story. And that's such an amazing gift to have as a storyteller. I think that was the in-game story that resonated with me the most. And, just a guy that we've missed ever since his last game in 2016.
No, I remember that one. That might be my pick as well. But I think one of the things that really impressed me about him was you've seen so many players and broadcasters with his sort of longevity in the media kind of turn on modern baseball and end up sort of decrying, and maybe they have legitimate gripes, but maybe spending too much time sort of outlining and detailing and chronicling each of those problems with modern baseball, where I never really got that from Vin, where I got sort of a lifelong love of the sport and a continued positivity to the very end. You've seen that clip of his last sort of salutation and the Irish poem and Irish benediction, and he just was unfailingly positive. Mm-hmm. And that is such a hard note to continue to ring. As a writer, cynicism creeps in because you're in those press boxes for bad games and you have bad interactions with players and you can spot maybe something in the game that you don't like. And you can start to sort of pick at it like a scab. He just sort of, I don't think that he wouldn't acknowledge those things. He might acknowledge it and say, you know, things were different in a different time, but he didn't put that value judgment on it that a lot of older players and broadcasters have.
Yeah, I just think that constant joy around the game. I imagine that for most people doing any job for as long as Vin called games, like you'd find it dull and boring at a certain point, no matter what that job was. You never got that sense. It could be a meaningless game at the end of a season with the Dodgers going nowhere, and you'd still enjoy listening to the stories that Vin would tell on the broadcast. And I don't think we'll ever have another person quite like him in the sport. I mean, working solo and doing the pre and post stuff that he did for so long too, just truly an amazing talent and just someone that really changed the game in a way that influenced thousands of people that get to talk about it and write about it today. So definitely someone that will be missed. And I've really just enjoyed reading a lot of the tributes and hearing a lot of new stories, but things that were before my time especially. And I really just enjoyed that coverage, even though it's very sad that Vin Scully is gone at the age of 94. We are going to go. If you'd like to ask a question for a future episode, you can send those our way. ratesandbarrels@theathletic.com is the email address. You can drop those questions on this video on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel if you haven't done so already. You can find Eno on Twitter @EnoSaris. You can find me @DerekVanRiper. That's going to do it for this episode of Rates and Barrels. We are back with you on Monday.
Thanks for listening.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.